Our next case today is number 05-1102, In Re David A. Barnes and Nancy K. Barnes. This is the appeal of Joseph M. Black, Jr. Mr. Black.
Yes, sir. Thank you very much, Your Honor. If it pleases the court, my name is Joe Black, and I'm the appellant here as the standing trustee. This case was started in the bankruptcy court by the filing of a 13 by the Barneses. At that time, ECMC, Educational Credit, filed a claim. Pursuant to 1302, I objected to that claim because I didn't feel collection costs were viable and allowable. At that time, the district court removed reference, and the district court became the trial court of record for this claim. Normally, the district court is an appellate court step up, but in this specific action, it was, in fact, the trial court. There was no actual trial. All the evidence was stipulated into evidence. ECMC relies upon a CFR which purports to grant them an 18.06% collection cost. They added those collection costs at the time of filing of the claim, stating that they were owed that money as of the date of the petition.
And the district court makes that finding too. The district court specifically says the obligation to pay collection costs attached before the Barneses filed for bankruptcy.
Your Honor, in addressing that, there is no evidence anywhere in the record that anybody complied with that regulation. There was no evidence that any letter was written. In fact, if you review the depositions, I ask ECMC.
Just so that I'm clear what your argument is, the district court makes this finding, I think, as a matter of law, you know, that the regulatory structure is what it is, and your attack, as I understand it, is on the way the regulation works. You know, did anybody go study, averaging data and so on? Is that correct?
That was one of them, but not the basis. Before they can charge that 18% collection cost, they must do certain things. One of them is to write the letter to the debtor. One of them is to offer rehabilitation. One of them is to notify when the claim has been transferred. There's nothing in the record anywhere that was done.
Well, everyone else had been doing it. I mean, EMS the last.
Excuse.
He never asked for rehabilitation from his earlier creditors, Great Lakes or the Department of Education.
That's not the requirement. The requirement is that the letter be written. There was no showing or proof to me as the 13 trustee. I don't represent the Barnes. I represent the other unsecured creditors that get significantly impacted. I also want to put this in perspective, Your Honor. Although this is a $1,000 case, when you apply it to the Chapter 13 program, just ECMC's claim is somewhere between $18 million and $36 million. That $18 to $36 million would go to them, not the other unsecured creditors, you know. So I believe compliance is necessary. We're talking a substantial sum of money. If you say the $6.75 billion that's overdue by the Department of Education at 18%, then we're really talking about money spread throughout bankruptcy courts. This is a substantial amount of money. They should be required to comply with that. Further, Your Honor, since we're talking about this regulation, I would respectfully ask that I read part of the Federal Register that is an addendum 2 to the ECMC. The loan industry comments are correct that the proposed change precludes agencies from continuing to assess collection costs up front at a time when the agency has not yet incurred those costs. The Secretary notes that the borrower is not legally obligated to pay costs which have not been incurred. This regulatory change is intended to require the guarantee agencies to charge only those costs that have incurred and to prohibit upfront loading of collection costs. the only time a cost is actually incurred is when there's a collection of money. Then they assess those costs. Further, the secretary notes, however,
there's... You say that repeatedly in your brief, and I have to say that your approach strikes me as contrary to virtually every instance of commercial behavior I can think of. You know, when you buy a product at a store, the price reflects the fact that some people are shoplifting. When you get a credit card, you have a certain interest rate on the card that reflects the fact that some people never pay their credit card debts. It's always the people who pay who wind up absorbing the costs of the people who don't pay.
We're not talking about the people that don't pay absorbing
yes,
the
you
costs.
Were. You complained in your brief that it's unfair to cause the Barneses and people in their position to absorb the collection costs of the real deadbeats who never wind up paying a nickel.
Well, you're not asking that the Barnes absorb those, because I am not and have never taken the position that collection cost is dischargeable outside bankruptcy court. I don't represent the Barnes. I'm representing the poor unsecured creditors in these cases where 18% of the money that's not entitled goes to ECMC and does not go to them. The doctors, the hospitals.
But that has to do with the plan, because there are plenty of plans where student loans are involved where the student loan creditor doesn't get very much of a payment during the life of the plan precisely because it's non-dischargeable. They still have to keep paying afterwards.
But they're getting 18% more than they're entitled to.
Not necessarily. What if they're getting $10 a month? The whole debt may be 18% more, but the payment that goes out during the plan and the amount that's left for the unsecured creditors is a function of the plan.
The amount that goes out under the plan is a pro rata percentage. So,
and that's exactly my point. You can agree to whatever you want to in a plan, and if you wanted to pay the unsecured creditors 100 cents on the dollar over the 3-year period or the 5-year period or whatever you've chosen, you might have a very small payment to the ECMCs of the world and let them go collect it in the post-bankruptcy time. It's up to the plan.
I don't believe that's a correct.
I mean, it may not be this plan, but I'm saying structurally speaking, you can do what you want to in a plan.
This court is held in the past that you cannot unfairly discriminate against like-type claims. These are unsecured claims. They're all going to be paid pro rata. What you've allowed ECMC to do is up their claim by 18% when they're not legally obligated. Those funds are not legally theirs. Even the Secretary of Education has said they are not legally entitled to that 18% until they collect the money. That is in the comments to this regulation and the Secretary's interpretation of that.
Well, we'll hear from the Secretary about that.
In this case, as I stated originally, there was an assumption by the district court that someone complied with the regulations. There's no evidence in the record that the necessary steps to follow that regulation were in fact done.
You know, this doesn't sound to me like the argument the district court is addressing in her opinion. You implied that you were raising a constitutional challenge to this regulation.
I said
which
it was
a failure. And she says, the issue we are asked to resolve here relates to the constitutionality of a federal regulation. And at the detailed level, whether every step of a regulation was followed is not a constitutional challenge.
But, Your Honor, she was the trial court. She denied the objection, period.
All I'm saying is you have to present the legal arguments you're making to the trial court. And if your argument was failure to comply with the regulation, you have an obligation to alert the court to that.
And I think I did. But on the same token, when I object to a claim, the claimant has the legal obligation to show that they are entitled to that. They did not. They made no showing. You cannot shift a burden to a trustee that's required to review claims to make sure that they're accurate, to prove that what they did was accurate. That's like having a secured creditor file a claim but not attach any perfection and saying, that's okay, it's not. They have to prove that they are entitled to that. They did not prove it at all. I also believe that this was arbitrary and capricious in that the 18% did not designate that that was a valid collection costing of 13. We have here where ECMC was awarded a no-bid contract because of their expertise in bankruptcy. If they're allowing expertise in bankruptcy, for one thing, it should be a common segregated item. I'll save my time for rebuttal. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Black. We'll hear now from Ms. Grove.
May it please the Court. My name is Tara Lee Grove, and I represent the Department of Education. With me is Mr. Dan Fisher on behalf of Educational Credit Management Corporation, which I will refer to as ECMC for short during this argument. The government has reserved 10 minutes of the time for its presentation, and ECMC has reserved 5 minutes. The Higher Education Act requires a borrower who has defaulted on a guaranteed student loan to pay reasonable collection costs. The statute does not define reasonable collection costs. Accordingly, the Secretary has issued regulations to elucidate that term, including the regulation at issue here, which provides parameters for the assessment of reasonable collection costs by state and private guarantee agencies. The Secretary's regulation is clearly a permissible construction of the statute under the deferential standard in Chevron and must be sustained.
Well, can you speak to this question of noncompliance in terms of notice provisions, which counsel made much of?
The Chapter 13 trustee seems to be bringing at the oral argument of an issue that he hasn't relied on either in the proceedings below in the district court or in his appellate brief, although there is an oblique reference to it in his reply brief. There are certain requirements once a guarantee agency takes over a loan to provide notice to a debtor, basically inform the debtor, you owe this loan and you must pay it. If you don't, we will report you to credit agencies, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. There's no indication in the record that the previous guarantee agency, which took over the loan in 1989, did not conform with these, and the Secretary of Education is confident that it did provide these notice requirements in 1995 when the Secretary itself took over the loan. And there is absolutely nothing in this record to indicate that these notice requirements were not complied with, nor is there any indication why this would be significant as to the regarding the facial challenge to 34 CFR 682.410B, which is the issue in this case.
So, I mean, I suppose your point would then have to be, since this issue was not placed on the table below, the Secretary never had the chance to go back and produce the evidence that would have shown that this notice was given?
That would be correct. The issue is not the Chapter 13 has waived this issue by not presenting it to the district court and not presenting it in his opening brief, at least not clearly presenting it in his opening brief to this court. I'm happy to address any of the other issues in this case if the court has any further questions regarding the Secretary's interpretation of the regulation and of the statute.
No, because, I mean, your bottom line is you're assuming that all these other notice provisions were complied with, and so therefore it was ripe at
That's
the time
correct.
That the bankruptcy case was filed.
And both the statute and the regulation not only entitled ECMC to ask for these collection costs, but required ECMC to seek collection costs. If there are no further questions, we ask that the judgment of the district court be affirmed. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Grove. We'll hear now from Mr. Fisher.
Good Good morning. May it please the Court. My name is Dan Fisher from Educational Credit Management Corporation. I understand that the issue this morning is somewhat of a moving target. We've segued off of the constitutionality of the underlying collection cost regulation a little bit to the notice provided by the guarantee agencies. And just so the Court's aware, there's to clear up some misstatements, this wasn't, in fact, a no-bid contract that ECMC has with the Department of Education. ECMC is a specialized guarantor. We function as the primary guarantor for the Commonwealth of Virginia. We also have it's not a contract with the Department of Education because there's no fee for service exchanged. We have a charter with the Department of Education pursuant to our guarantee agency function to provide specialized bankruptcy services on behalf of the student loan community. This includes the Department of Education, as well as opportunities for the other 34, 35 guarantee agencies around the country, and most of them do actually take advantage of this service. So this isn't a no-bid contract that we have with the Department of Education, and in fact, there's no requirement for this to be bid. The second thing I wanted to bring up is the fact that when a claim is paid by the guarantee agency, that guarantee agency under 34 CFR section 682.410B has the obligation to notify the debtor of his right to seek rehabilitation, as well as the notice provision that 60 days without payment will incur collection costs under the regulation. And in this case, the original claim was paid by Great Lakes Higher Ed, which is one of these other FFEL student loan guarantee agencies. There's no evidence in the record that Great Lakes failed to provide this notice, and it's important to keep in mind that this was done approximately 7 or 8 years prior to the filing of bankruptcy in this case, and the trustee has never raised that issue until now, and so that's not really the issue. ECMC as a guarantee agency stands in the shoes of the prior guarantee agency, and if Great Lakes sent the notice, that notice is deemed imputed to be sent by ECMC as well. The other thing I'd like to address briefly is the rehab issue, and as we indicated in our briefs, rehab has several components, none of which were satisfied here by the debtors. This has to be initiated by the debtor, has to be agreed that there would be 12 on-time, reasonable and affordable monthly payments, and then there has to be a resale of the note back to a qualified lender. Absolutely none of these issues took place. David Barnes has never requested or even talked to anybody at any of the guarantee agencies or the Department of Education about rehabbing his loan, and there's no question that it wouldn't even begin to comply with that regulation.
Is it your position that the 12 on-time payments criterion can never be satisfied through compliance with a Chapter 13 plan?
It would be an unusual scenario, Your Honor, where that would be the case, because in this, because you would have to have an agreement between the creditor and the debtor within the confines of the Chapter 13, which of course would involve the trustee. So you can imagine a scenario by which a Chapter 13 debtor gets into bankruptcy, decides that he wants to have a rehab agreement and wants to make his monthly on-time payments reasonable and affordable to the guarantee agency, directly to the guarantee agency. He would have to get the trustee on board. We would certainly allow that, and then at the end of the 12 payments, we would have to get a rehab lender. And then the issue, of course, is whether we'd have to get the trustee's consent to do that. But this is really an academic game here, because under the regulation, under 682.410b2, the only benefit, or one of the only benefits of rehab, is that collection costs are limited to 18.5% and are then capitalized onto the principal balance when it's sent back down to the lender. In this case, the collection costs were 18.06%, so it would have absolutely no effect. Subject to the Court's questions, thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Fisher.
Thank you, Your Honors. I believe that as trustee, I have in every proceeding brought those issues up as for compliance. In fact, in my rebuttal, I set or in the initial briefs, district, we set out those five requirements, but none of them were complied with. They are asking again, but they don't have to prove it. that you have to assume that some other people did something correct. That's, again, back to my analysis of a call lender says they're secured. Well, they didn't get, they don't have to show a proof on their title that they were actually, that they got, that they had a security interest. And when they don't show that and didn't do it, I object to it, the secured
status. And so you're saying that you raised that whole notice problem before Judge Barker?
I said they didn't comply with the statute.
And specifically identified the fact that there were notice problems.
Well, in the depositions that were stipulated into evidence, we asked both ECMC if they had done it, and they said no because they were stayed. We asked the Department of Education if they had done it. They said no. I specifically asked the Department of Education if, in fact, they had these notices from Great Lake, and they said no, they didn't send them up to us. I assume they got them. So, yes, that evidence is in the record. It's been that way from all the time. The next thing is that they are now assuming that their collection costs are always 18.06%. As a 13 trustee, mine was 9% at the start. My costs now are 5.3%. The Secretary of Education only allows them to collect what their actual costs are when the payment is received. It's hard for me to believe that 8.06% is the same percentage every year. They did not modify their claim. They did not do anything. The way the system is set up, they are allowed the actual claim, which was the principal and accrued interest. When they collect that money, they are welcome to file an administrative claim for their 18% or 13% or 12% or 22%, whatever it is, on the date they receive the money.
I'm just kind of scanning Judge Barker's opinion. She doesn't make any reference to this whole notice argument.
No, she doesn't. She just denies my objection and remanded. She treats this as an appeal when she's truly the court of record, the trial court. She withdrew reference, and the only trial was there. Your Honor, in summary, they didn't comply with the regulation. There's no findings in that order anywhere where they complied. The regulation and the Secretary himself says they are not legally allowed to assess collection costs until they receive the money, and then only at that percentage. For that, Your Honor, I ask that you overturn this, send it back for a further determination, and allow my objection to stand. Thank you very much.
Our thanks to all counsel. The case will be taken under advisement.